they go, you're down, and they're going over you, so that there's able to be kind of light, the light space below that they're growing into. So when you look up.
Yeah, no, it's really great, isn't it? That, I'm just thinking as we're talking, it's very much, you feel like you're part of, you're sort of sunken into the, really part of the land, aren't you? Part of the rocks and the...
Exactly, dug down deep, like 20 metres below the surface where everyone else is walking. We're down this little crevice.
Yeah, that's
fantastic. Secret spot, really, isn't it? We're still on top now, some white limestone, which the water's slowly going along and it's descending down into a turquoise pool at the base. And the turquoise pool looks like it's really quite deep. It's probably about 7 foot down there as the water descends into it. And that's where we're about to take our next dip.
You know, Dad particularly was really into swimming, and his granddad, I know, used to, and we used to joke about it, but he used to swim all year round, and when they were kids he'd made a plunge pool in their garden, and they always used to talk about him breaking the ice in the winter to go in the plunge pool. And we used to live in Cambridge, and he used to swim in the River Cam all year round. So I feel, you know, I do sometimes think about that connection with him. But it's just such a lovely thing to do. You know, and you get sort of addicted to doing it. And it's lovely that Anna enjoys it so much as well. I mean, Grace, my other daughter as well, is really keen. It's just a lovely thing to do.
It's a real family affair,
yeah.
Taking the kids swimming.
Yeah. We quite often go together, don't we, after...
I come home from school.
I remember last year as well, a couple of times getting home, and Anna was sitting with a wetsuit on waiting for me when I got there, saying, can we go to the river?
Like intrepid explorers,
yeah.
Forging your own way across sky together.
Definitely.
Your dad found that one. He found the waterfall up at the top, which was wonderful. So he must be good tracking them down.
That was Wild Swimming, and it was presented by Rachel Kinley and produced by Kate Bissell. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, live here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Katie Derham. We're now going to hear a simply monumental work, Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conducted by their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov, who is something of a Bruckner fan. The symphony is sometimes called the Tragic or the Church of Faith, but don't despair, it has one of the most life-affirming finales you will ever hear. Bruckner wrote the piece at a particularly miserable time in his life. He'd moved to Vienna in his 40s, a talented composer, a wonderful organist, who knew that his comfortable, easy life in the small town of Linz had long since stopped providing a challenge. So he headed to the city of his dreams, the city of Mozart, of Schubert, of Beethoven, expecting to find inspiration, intelligent appreciation, and applause. Instead, he spent 10 years impoverished, unappreciated, his music at best ignored, at worst reviled. He was hardly making any money, and though he was delighted to earn the praise and friendship of one of his heroes, Wagner, that association made him even more unpopular with certain sections of the press, who were absolutely vile to him. Still, it was at this time that he wrote some of his most sublime music. Quietly, doggedly, he produced four extraordinary symphonies between 1871 and 1876, working on structure and form, returning to similar themes but always finding new character. His fifth, which we're hearing tonight, is one which should be savoured, as one critic put it, like musical slow food. Here's conductor Ilan Volkov with his thoughts on this massive work.
What I think is very interesting in this music, that it's not only about spirituality, which is always, you know, what's being talked about. It has also a lot of really folkloristic elements, a lot of really dramatic moments, which come almost from opera. You can hear really the influence of Wagner in this music. And so it's not only about this. If it was only this, this would be quite boring, I think. It's more about the contrasts that are there that's important, but also, of course, about this kind of very important distillation, I mean, the fragmentation in this piece especially. I mean, there's almost no material. The material is very condensed, much more than any other previous symphony of his. So this is really the most modernistic from his early symphonies, and it really leads the way to the Ninth Symphony and the Eighth. I kind of find it less interesting to talk about the spirituality in it, because I just feel that this is quite hard to translate into words exactly what it is. There are elements, of course, that you can put your finger very clearly, but it's more about the general attitude and acceptance of life and God, very much into his music and into his life. You can really sense that.
So we have four movements. Numbers 1, 2, and 4 start with pizzicato strings, and this symphony is sometimes called the Pizzicato Symphony. It starts very slowly with an adagio that picks up pace to an allegro. The second movement is unambiguously slow in tempo, and it's rather sad. Then a scherzo follows, and then a glorious finale. Well, the stage has filled up considerably since the first half of tonight's prom. We've now got banks of brass ready and waiting. And I should just mention, it's a very special day for flautist Rosemary Locke, who's celebrating 25 years with the orchestra today. Well, as we await tonight's conductor, Ilan Volkov, I could just add that he was chief conductor of this orchestra between 2003 and 2009. And through the orchestra, he championed many new works. Now he comes on, though, to conduct one of his favourites, Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra with Ilan Volkov.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
the life-affirming finale to Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, performed there with great passion and vigour by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov. Who's returning to the stage to bring the orchestra to their feet once again. Paying particular attention to the wind players. Now bringing the brass to their feet. Great cheers here. This is a piece, you know, that wasn't performed at the Proms until 1964, when Charles Groves conducted it. And the great Brucknerians, if that's the word, followed suit. Heiting, Bernard Heiting, who's here tomorrow conducting Brahms. Two Brahms Proms coming up in the next couple of days under him. Then there was Gunter Vans and Claudio Abbado, of course. And until tonight, the most recent performance was in 2003, when the BBC Symphony Orchestra performed it under Jukka Pekka Saraselä. Ilan Volkov still applauding his orchestra, the orchestra of which he was chief conductor for 6 years. He's now about to take up a new position as music director and chief conductor of the Iceland Symphony Orchestra. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, meanwhile, having a very busy summer. They're off the Edinburgh International Festival in the next week or so. Mahler's Second Symphony. They've got the Scottish premiere of James McMillan's and John Passion. Lots of great stuff. Wonderful performance by them this evening. But as the applause continues, that's it for tonight's prom. Do come back, though, at 10:15. Victoria Mulliver and Matthew Barley will be back with their programme of Hungarian, Gypsy and jazz music. And this time tomorrow, as I said, it's the first of the two proms dedicated to Brahms, with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe conducted by legendary Bernard Heiting. So do tune in for that. But now it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. If you can't make that, then it'll be available on the BBC iPlayer for the next 7 days. Well, in about 17 minutes, that's at 9:30, we'll be hearing more about the composer of tonight's new concerto, Thomas Lacher. He'll be talking to Andrew McGregor in our Proms Composer Portrait. But first, more music by Anton Bruckner, but this time for voices. Bruckner was a committed Roman Catholic and wrote some of the finest liturgical music of the time for that church. We're going to hear Locus Iste, composed in 1869 for the new Linz Cathedral. Os Justi Meditabitur, a setting of Psalm 37, the mouth of the just is exercised in wisdom. And Christus Factus Est Pro Nobis, Christ for us became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Here are the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best.
Thank you.
three graduals by Bruckner, Locus Iste, Os Justi Meditabitur and Christus Factus Est. They were sung by the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best. And to end this sequence of Bruckner's motets, here is Ave Maria. Anton Bruckner's setting of Ave Maria. It was sung by the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best. This is Radio 3, it's 9:30 and time for our Proms composer portrait. This was recorded earlier this evening and it's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music, just a stone's throw from the Royal Albert Hall, where the world premiere of Thomas Lacher's new double concerto is one of the highlights of this evening's first prom. And Thomas will be telling us more about his music and the way he composes in just a moment. And we'll be hearing three pieces by him performed by young musicians from the Royal College of Music. A movement from his Sonata for Solo Cello, the Antennen Requiem for prepared piano, and his piano trio Kraken. Now, Thomas Lacher, at first glance, the worlds of a solo cello sonata and a double concerto with orchestra sound like just completely different sound worlds, and yet I do know that you say you like to compose for very specific musicians, that the musicians who are playing the pieces, the first performers, are what inspires a lot of your music.
Right, yeah. So the cello sonata, we'll only hear the last movement of it, was written for Natalie Klein. And so this evening's double concerto is, of course, written for Rika Mulova and Matthew Barley. And actually, we all met at more or less the same festival, Natalie and Matthew and me. And I find that both of them are very special musicians, but very different musicians. So for Natalie, she's a very sensitive player and a very expressive person as well. And Matthew is a very, 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 we say neugierig in Germany. In German, he wants to know everything. He's very curious. He's very, very vivid, and he's an improviser. He comes from a totally different style of playing and everything, and he's very much interested in rhythm and in jazz and all that. So maybe one can also hear this in the pieces.
And this Sonata for Solo Cello for Natalie Klein, it's from 2007, but how does her character actually inhabit the piece? What is your starting point when you've met a musician and you're beginning to find out about them, and also the way they play, presumably?
Well, you know, it's not so much about her character. It's more about maybe, you know, giving me a clue why I want to this musician have to play my music. It's more about her playing, her tone, her expression, her presence on stage, all that. And I think that's most of the times very different from the character of a person. What you are on stage is not the same person which you are behind the stage. So it's more about the musician, Natalie Klein, than about the human being, Natalie.
And by giving it the title of sonata, you do seem to be quite deliberately placing yourself within a certain musical tradition.
Well, you know, I'm a bit fed up with all those titles. You know, every composer has to invent a very funny or cute or, I don't know, title. In those days, it has become a kind of a title mania. And so I really wanted to step back at one point from this. I also, of course, did this myself. And I think this is really a sonata because it's a three-movement piece. It's a piece with a clear tonal structure over the whole piece with one bow. It has got everything also of what we don't hear now, of something like a scherzo movement in the middle, and the slow movement is at the end. So it very much refers to a classical form of a sonata. So it's a sonata.
Well, we're going to start at the end of it, as it were,
yeah,
aren't we? So
yeah.
Maybe just give us some idea of what we've missed.
Oh,
before we hear the finale.
Well, the first movement you've missed pretty much the same as the last one. No, it starts off slowly and then, maybe the centerpiece is the second movement, which is a very rhythmically focused, fast and virtuoso movement. It's a combination of a scherzo on the one hand and of a tarantella at the other hand. And it's also that it refers to a piece which I've played with Natalie as well, which is the Messian Quatuor pour la fin du temps. And the rhythmical thinking of and methods of Messian are very close to my thinking. So I'm not the person who comes from jazz rhythms and you know, swing and time and laid back and all that, but I'm much more coming from a motoric precise rhythm with added with different meters and with different how should I say, yeah, with different groups of threes and fours and fives and all that.
So that's how we get to the finale.
Yeah.
Where does it leave us?
Where do we end? We end at the finale, and that's also something I almost always have to do in my pieces. I have to create a great excitement and a climax in order to make silence possible at the end, or also inside a piece, you know. It's like if you are on a very, very busy street, and only when you close the door, then you close the door and you can hear the silence, or you even can more than hear it. You feel it's a body of silence standing here at once. And it's also, you know, you are in a room like this, and then you'd hear, for example, nothing, and then you turn off a loudspeaker or something, and then you hear the sound which was there before but isn't there anymore. So it's about those phenomena also. And everything what you can imagine with silence seems to be right. This can be from a very relieved atmosphere or feeling towards a really catastrophic feeling as well.
Well, to perform the third and last movement of Thomas Lacher's Sonata for Solo Cello, please welcome Frédéric Legrand.
Thank you.
The last movement of the Sonata for Solo Cello by Thomas Lacher, written for Natalie Klein in 2007, played for us by Frédéric Legrand, who will be back on stage a little later for a performance of music from Kraken, Thomas Lacher's piano trio. Now, Thomas, you're from Innsbruck in Austria, but you studied in Vienna. So how much do you actually feel a part of Viennese and Austro-German tradition?
Well, I really don't feel as a part of it, but this may be wrong. Many people say that they feel some kind of Austrian sound in my music, and I don't know what I should think of it. I rather come from, well, musically even from minimalism, from other traditions, but not so much. I grew up with Bartok very much, but not so much with Schoenberg and Berg, and only discovered those things later. And I'm still, well, I'm a great big skepticist about Schoenberg. I mean, I've played many of his things, including his piano concerto, and especially this piece made me very skeptic about him, because it's, well, because of many things, it would be too take too long a time to. But mainly because he was such a guru, and I don't like that. Still, whenever I compose, many things I've heard in my youth come up to my mind and then come again. And so, it's as a matter of fact, of course, I grew up with Bach and Mozart and Schumann and Schubert, and maybe in a way this can be heard. And if you speak about tradition, I can also say that my music is, in a way, written for a very, so to say, normal situation, for normal classical concert situation where people are sitting in a hall, listening, having concentration for, I don't know, some half an hour or some 20 minutes. So it's also has also got nothing to do with 4-hour Morton Feldman string quartets. So and in this way, of course, I stand in the tradition of classical music.
And when you were in Vienna, you, of course, as you said, you were also studying as a pianist while you were finding your voice as a composer as well.
Yeah.
And it seems from a lot of your music and the way in which you work with piano and prepared piano particularly, as we hear in the double concerto and as yeah. we're about to hear, that the instrument affects the way you think about your music quite a lot. What are you doing when you prepare a piano? What are you trying to find inside the instrument?
Well, I don't think that at first I tried to find something, but I tried to escape something. You know, I tried to escape the piano sound, because I had the piano sound around me all the time, the normal piano sound, and I had been practicing, you know, all that crazy stuff. And I wanted to find a way of having the piano sound like it was my intention to sound. So the piano stood in the center of musical development, let's say, until 1930. For me, it has always been Bartok's second piano concerto, the last, and Reg 3, the last two real climaxes of great piano concerti, and where, you know, where the most advanced techniques of composition and instrumentation and combinations with the orchestra met with the real sound of the piano. Then the piano somehow took a sideway and musical development went somewhere else. And I discovered, as many composers of course do and did, I discovered a lot about the piano when recording for electronic music, when sampling sounds, trying inside the piano, trying to find sounds in the piano, to record them, prepare a tape or a live electronic thing or whatever. So this opened a way for me to be able to compose for piano at all.
And it takes us very much, that world of sampling takes us into the next piece we're going to hear, doesn't it? Which is the Antennen Requiem for H. Antennas,
yeah,
aerials,
right.
And a Requiem for H. Tell us something about the background to the piece.
Well, I've actually already done this. It is a very short piece in memory of a very dear friend of mine, a composer called Heimo Wisse, who was a highly inventive and inspiring musician for me. He died, I think, in 15 years ago, almost now. And it's in memory of him because I did a lot of the sampling stuff with him. And what you hear are just, you know, some strutchy, some little what's leftovers, you know, from his world, maybe.
And there's no score as such. There's a set of not quite instructions in German, and there's some apparatus. Yeah. You have the piano, you have two massage balls, these rubber balls with the spikes sticking out of them, some stones, large to small stones, some pieces of aluminium. Yeah. So how do you tell a performer what to do with them?
Well, it's just the system of Flaschenpost, which is not a song by Schubert, but a message in a bottle. And I just tell the people who want to play it on the phone, or I write them an email what to do and how to get this music done. And I like the idea of not having a score, you know, because it gives way to thinking and feeling and exploring the instrument and the sounds, and maybe also at some point something quite different will come out. I don't know.
And there's a sense of ritual about this Requiem, isn't there, which it maybe shares with the second movement of the new double concerto?
Yes, but this is really far more strange than in the double concerto. But you know, whenever you do something in the piano, normally people start to laugh, and it's just not about this in this piece. So you really have to perform it with conviction, otherwise it doesn't work. And if you are on stage and perform something with real conviction, you will simply get people really listen to the sounds coming out of this black animal. And I think when one really hears sounds like this for the first time, I think it's beautiful.
And I like the end of the instructions that I read for it. Es dauert so lange, wie es eben dauern soll, which is, it lasts as long as it needs to last.
Right, yeah. Which is always always a problem for the royalty companies, you know. How much should they pay me?
Well, let's hear the piece, and I'm really looking forward to this. To perform Antennen Requiem for H, prepared piano, and in this case, two musicians, pianist Petr Limonov from the Royal College of Music and the composer. Thank you. was Antennas, Requiem for H, written in 1999 by Thomas Lacher. We just heard it performed live here at the Royal College of Music by the composer and pianist Petr Limonov. By the composer and the pianist, Petr Limonov. Now, a piece for prepared piano with no traditional piano technique involved at all.
Right.
And so a denial of the classical piano tradition in a way.
In a way, yes. Yeah. I don't touch a single key.
And where you write your music, I find interesting, because I know you have a very modern house in the mountains outside Innsbruck, and you must have some great views in many directions. Does that actually affect the way you compose, your place in the landscape there and the quality of that landscape?
Well, I wouldn't really say so. I can't see the house when I'm inside, so it doesn't affect me so much that it's looking great from outside. But what is true on the other side is that I get very many sounds from nature. As I already said, you know, when you are in silence or in a state of almost silence, when you are in the mountains, when you hear the sounds of nature, like the little rivers or the bells of the cows or the cracking of a tree in a wind, in a storm, when you experience, you know, a lightning, when you are right in nature. I mean, these are just existential experiences for me, and they very much, I don't know, I mean, if you have a little river beside your house, it's almost the sound, same sound as you are living just at a highway. It's not really much of a difference, but you feel it's so different. So it's also about that. It's about the contrast of urban life and rural life or nature, or what we call nature, what has been left over by us and what we call nature. As you heard, I mean, this is musique concrète, nothing more and nothing less. And sometimes it feels to me that a landscape can be music and nothing more and nothing less.
Now, we must find out something about the piece we're going to hear next, your piano trio, Kraken, because I think to quite a lot of British listeners, Kraken immediately brings up a myth of sea monsters or perhaps a novel by John Wyndham, but you say it's neither of those things.
No. I used to have little enigmas for my titles earlier on, and this is a very early piece, and Kraken is a town, is a part of a little town where I come from, and friends of mine are living there, and the piece is dedicated to them, so it seemed obvious to call it Kraken.
Now, you've said elsewhere that it's in some ways a reflection of your own compositional history.
Right, you know, there are five movements, and we'll hear two of them, and each movement more or less comes from a different stage of thinking and of development. And it starts with the solo violin movement, and then there is a piano violin movement, then there is the third movement we will hear, which is a movement with very many, one pattern just circling around itself. This is for a duo, more or less, for violin and cello, and some sounds from the piano added, also taken out from an endless circle of a pattern, coming to itself at the end again. And then there comes the fourth movement. This is the first movement to be played by all of the three players, really. So this is the build-up of the piece.
And it's constructed in layers of different ideas that you've tried at different times in your career as a composer. And I was just thinking, if this was finished in 1997, do you feel like adding something now, because you know, a lot has changed in your music, an orchestra, for example?
Yeah, no, not at all. No, I mean, this. I really was not so much a composer at that time. I overthought about composing, and I composed some little pieces, and I denied having developed a style. I didn't want to develop a style. I wanted to find a new world in every piece I wanted to find a real new thing, and it was very surprising for me that this piece then formed out as a real piece, because I think though it's very, the angles are quite wide, it's still, if you hear it as a whole, it somehow is really a piece, and that's nice, and it came about by chance, more or less.
And is this idea, though, that you question some of the ideas you've had as a composer and discard some of them, put some of them on one side as part of the process of writing this piece?
I'm afraid so, yes. Yeah.
And it's a trio, a piano trio, and yet there is also, there is another set of sounds, because we have a little preparation of the piano here as well.
Yes.
So you do have effectively a fourth instrument, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yes. And that's a major point in preparing the piano, because I always, coming from piano solo music, I always see that composers want to have many layers of sounds and rhythms within one piece, and it's always very hard for a player to make these really audible, you know, these layers, even in a Bach fugue or so. And so I simply muted some of the notes here, in order to be able to create a real distinctive second layer of sound, and to have in this case, not so much in this movement, but in the next movement, which we don't hear, that you really have another rhythmical layer than the rest of the piano, so to say.
So in that sense, it's actually closer to the way in which you use the prepared piano in the double concerto.
Right, yes.
Because that you have a separate set of instruments and set of sounds working as a concertino group at the back
of
the orchestra.
There are some, percussion plays a big role in the new double concerto. So this means we have two orchestra percussions with wipes and mallets and all that stuff. And we have a concertino percussionist who is more an improviser than a percussionist in the ensemble, and who makes more sounds than really percussion work. But I on the piano do more percussion work in the double concerto, together with the soloists mainly.
Well, let's hear the third and fourth movements of Thomas Lacher's piano trio, Kraken. And to perform it, please welcome back to the stage pianist Petr Limonov, violinist Yuka Matsumoto, and cellist Frédéric Legrand. Thank you.
Thank you.